Welcome back to Air Quality Matters. We already have the tools and knowledge we need to make a difference to the quality of the air we breathe in our built environment. The conversations we have and how we share what we know is the key to our success. I'm Simon Jones, and coming up, a very special episode this week in partnership with the AIVC and a conversation about a document on residential ventilation and health called Technical Note 68. To help me introduce the guests and the topic, I welcome Arnold Jensens, Professor of Building Physics at Ghent University and Operating Agent for the AIVC. Hi Arnold, you're really welcome.
Hi Simon, thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, no, not at all. Perhaps for those that aren't familiar, tell me a little bit about the role of the AIVC, and in particular, the outputs like technical notes and VIPs and what they are.
Okay, yes, the AIVC is short for the Air Infiltration and Ventilation Center. And it's in fact the International Energy Agency's Information Center on Energy Efficient Ventilation for Good Indoor Air Quality in Buildings. It's one of the annexes which is running under the IEA's Energy in Buildings and Communities program. It has existed since 1979, and since we're an information center, we mainly focus on organizing events and on preparing publications. And typical formats are more in-depth reports. Those are the technical notes, which really delve into the subject and offer a wide look at this subject. And ventilation information papers are shorter papers on a specific subject, which are easier to digest for the reader.
That's really interesting. And one of the goals of annexes is this isn't pure academic literature, isn't it? It's to create information that has practical use in industry and in the marketplace and at a regulatory level, that they're outputs that have practical value, aren't they?
Yes, that's correct. Many people involved in AIVC are, in fact, from the research community, but we try to combine all the knowledge from researchers and try to translate this into meaningful applications and into lessons for both industry, but also policymakers.
At this particular technical note, Technical Note 68, was about residential ventilation and health, and was an important document at the time. It was produced, I think, in 2016, which is nearly 10 years ago, and edited and authored by people probably quite familiar if you listen regularly to the podcast, the likes of Walter Borsboom, William de Gids, Jennifer Logue, and Max Sherman from the States, and our very own Pavel Wargotsky, who's been on several times. What was it in particular about Technical Note 68 that made it so useful at the time and probably still very useful today?
Yes, indeed. I think the technical note is still very useful today, even though it was written almost 10 years ago. But it was an attempt to combine all the information available at the time on indoor sources, exposure to residents, and on the health impact of indoor pollutants. And this is quite important, because when designing ventilation, typically engineers rely on ventilation standards, which mainly prescribe flow rates without real background on how these flow rates impact health. And most standards are based on research to provide acceptable indoor air quality, but based on perceived indoor air quality. So how can discomfort due to odors be reduced? Well, of course, an important function of ventilation is to create a healthy indoor environment. And there's still not sufficient knowledge about this, in fact, today. So research is still continuing on exploring how exposure to contaminants of concern, as they are called, impact our health.
Yeah, absolutely. And so a few weeks ago, before us recording this intro, I sat down with Pavel Wargocki, one of the original editors of this report, Valerie Le Prince, who has very in-depth knowledge in ventilation and standards globally, and Ben Jones, who's really followed on some of the work that was started with Jennifer Logue and Max Sherman as part of this report, to discuss technical note 68 today, what it means now, and the importance of that document over the last 10 years. Arnold, as part of this podcast, it's part of a wider project looking at bringing some of this content to life. What can people expect to see from the AOVC embedded around this podcast and Technical Note 68?
Yes, in fact, we're starting up a new type of communication with AIVC. As I explained before, we have our events like conferences and workshops. We have our publications. Most of this information is available through our website. But we have the feeling that we can achieve a higher impact of all the knowledge that is available there by communicating it in different ways. So that's why we're starting up a new communication project, comms project, as we call it, where we look into more advanced ways of communication, more contemporary ways of communication, where we have podcasts, but this is a starting point to collect various types of information and guide the listeners to these various information sources. So we have the publications, as I told you, but we also have webinar recordings that are available there on the various topics related to residential ventilation and health. For instance, this tech note, but also more recent papers on ventilation regulations in various countries and how they are gradually developing into a more performance-based standard. So all this information will be available through the website.
Absolutely. And that website is at the AIVC website, and we'll also include it in the show notes to this podcast, and you'll see more information surrounding this. That's brilliant, Ardell. Thanks a million. So it just leaves it to us to introduce our guests, and I'll hand it over to you for that privilege.
Yes, thank you, Simon. And thanks for listening, everybody. So we will be listening to a conversation with Pavel Wargocki, Valerie Le Prince, and Ben Jones about Technical Note 68.
Having read back through it, as you no doubt have, for you, has anything particularly changed from an indoor air quality perspective and health since that original pass 10 years ago?
I think it's just about to change. I think we're seeing the fruition of TN 68 right now, this year, 2025. I think that's the year we're starting to see things change. The reason for that is because the outcomes that were documented in TN 68 are being considered by huge organisations like ASHRAE. So there's a new pathway to compliance that's about to go into its 62.2 standard, ventilation and indoor air quality, that is health-based. And that's the first of its kind, and that's exactly what TN 68 was advocating.
And I think we will see that also in Europe with a new EPBD that has been published last year that now stresses the fact that when you make an energy performant building, it needs to be also safe as much as it can be, or at least indoor environment quality need to be taken into account. And this is really new in the energy performance building directive. So this is coming into force really now.
Max Sherman did a talk where he showed the major plot that's in TN 68, and it's on the x-axis is all the contaminants. There's about 15 contaminants in that, plus carbon monoxide on the end, tagged on the end. And then on the y-axis, you've got harm. And you can clearly see the harm that each of these contaminants cause. It's so powerful. I remember talking to Max after that. That's how I started to get to know him. That was 2012.
2013, yeah.
13, okay. So you lose track of time so quickly. So that's 12 years ago. It then became fleshed out It added in more authors from elsewhere around the world, because that initial work had been the brainchild of Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories. It was probably led by Max and Ian and Walker and Jenny Logue. And it's taken a very long time. I think, you know, we're in a completely different paradigm than this harm-based paradigm. We exist in an exposure limit value paradigm where we just want to keep contaminant concentrations below some threshold, whatever that may be, and it depend where you live.
Yeah.
And it's the first time that we start to say, well, maybe this isn't the right way to do it. Maybe there's a way that actually ignores some of the politics that's inevitably involved in setting an exposure limit value. Because we've all been in these meetings where you sort of say, well, you know, what's the health evidence say? What do we think we can sell to industry? What do we think we can sell to government? And we sort of juggle those things and come up with a number.
You were part of that original conversation, Pavel, I guess, back when this, because you were one of the authors of this.
It actually started before that, because there were European projects which actually calculated the impact of different actions in terms of DALIs to improve indoor environment. There was an ENVI project, and there was another project that I cannot recall. But then they tried to put the estimate in the same way as the later on Max and Jennifer Locke did. I think the advantage of that approach is twofold. The first one, it actually target the pollutants. So we are not in sort of a gray area that everything may be or may not be, you know, harmful. So this is very important first. So we know where to target our actions. The second one is we can put the value on it. Because if you have to do everything, I mean, it will cost a lot of money. Now you can actually estimate what would be the cost and benefit of targeting those pollutants. So I think, and then the third one is, of course, innovation, because now we will be focusing on this and then much more effective in removing those. So I think those three elements are important in all this conversation, and it's fantastic that it goes to 62.2. And so it's only the benefit. At the time when we were making the writing, actually, because there have been a lot of pieces in this, there was also the direction of the research and policies and all that stuff that we put in. I think one thing that we didn't discuss at that time was sleep. So I think that is a new element that we have learned over the last 7 years, among others, with the project that we, again, sponsored by ASHRAE, that the sleep is also an important element here that plays a role in the residential environment and ventilation for sleep.
And looking back at that now, was it largely correct, do you think, in the pollutants that it was targeting? And what are they today? So when we fast forward now today, if we're looking at the residential setting with what we know about harm, what are we concerned about?
I think it has targeted directly the PM, which is now clearly the first things to deal with. And it's also targeted all the pollutants that, in my view, should not be forgotten. Because even if it's smaller than PM, it still has an impact, and it's really regional dependent. For example, the radon. Okay, maybe on a national, on an international basis, it may not be the main priority, while in some country it is really. And another thing is that we have to keep in mind with this classification that we know about things we measure, but for things we've never measured that may have an impact, maybe they are here and maybe they are very dangerous, but we just don't know it yet. And for example, for radon, if we take the example of France, we only measure it in some region. So we say, okay, maybe here it's dangerous, but here it's not dangerous. But actually, we have never done measurement in it. So maybe it is, but we just don't know it yet. But I think the pollutants that were targeted in this TN were, in the end, very good. Well, still right.
I mean, you're completely right. We this is just the beginning. It's definitely not the end. And there will be no end. We'll have to keep tracking materials in homes will change, human behaviours and activities will change, and that will introduce different sources and different contaminants. So, the principle is I think, broadly the right one. And that's to say, what's present in the air and in the buildings that we're interested in, and TIN 68 focuses on homes, but that work is now being repeated in other building types. And then to say, okay, so of those contaminants that we've measured in this building type, which ones cause the most harm? So you have to be both present and harmful. Otherwise, you know, we'd be regulating contaminants like ethanol, which has the greatest concentration by mass, but doesn't actually cause a whole lot of harm. So the work was revisited in the last 3 years, the Nottingham study, which was done by Gio Morantes, who's now at URAC, and it broadly shows it's the same contaminants we're interested in. He started to break things down a bit, but it's PM2.5, the coarse fraction matters. Deal with one, you'll get the other. So we'll just say particulates generally. And then you've got nitrogen dioxide, ozone, formaldehyde and radon. And the new study looking at offices broadly shows it's the same ones. Probably have to worry less about radon in offices, but that's probably what you'd expect too.
But the things we find harmful are things we understand very well are associated with our homes, aren't they, ultimately?
Well, but the things that could help not to be harmful is the ventilation that is not understood at all.
Yeah.
And the problem is it's the balance between what we do in the home and the ventilation system that will lead to a harmful or not environment. And the people tend not to really understand that both are needed to make a safe home, whatever safe may mean.
An acceptably safe home,
yeah, that's it.
Do you have a sense at this stage when we're looking at these indoor air quality contaminants, how much of this is indoor-generated pollutants and therefore controllable with background ventilation and the kind of things you're talking about, Valerie, or how much of it is likely to be external pollutants and therefore we need to think about filtration and the building fabric and things that might stop it getting in?
I think it's very difficult to generalize because that will depend on the type of housing that we are talking about and location of it. And I must say that many of those like formaldehyde, maybe acrolein, that is not present in the new, that was back then.
Right.
And so they probably will be generated indoors. PM2.5 and NO2, probably in homes, NO2 main source will be the gas cooking, but then when we eliminate that, we will have to deal with NO2 that is coming from outside for the specific locations. And then if we electrify our, you know, traffic, maybe NO2 will be just evaded. So we really don't know how to do this. PM2.5, it has both, and I think we need to pay attention to that there will be a lot of PM2.5 that is penetrating. But we also produce those pollutants indoors by our activities. So it is not that, let's say, PM2.5 can be produced during cooking, but many of the ultrafine particles and particles generally can be, and VOCs can be generated during cleaning of our houses. So it is not like it is there, but our activities can also bring them to life, I would say.
And it will change over time. We've got a national measurement campaign in France. The first one ended in 2005, and now we are finishing the second one. And between the two, we have national regulation on the emission of products, and lots of products have been forbidden. And we really see the difference between 2005 and 2025. Some pollutants like benzene, toluene has almost disappeared in the campaign. So it shows that the general policy on forbidden products and rating and so on is efficient to avoid this. But in the same time, we see that the level of radon is increased in the house, showing that at the same time, we have a lot of energy subsidies to improve the energy envelope, well, the envelope of the building. So basically inducing a reduction of the ventilation. So we see that we are starting to control the sources, but we are missing the point of controlling the ventilation at the same time to improve all pollutants level and not only pollutant emitted indoor.
Yeah, I suppose that's the advantage of general ventilation, is it's a catch-all for all pollutants, whereas source control is only effective with
one by one.
A particular source.
Yeah.
But we can, you know, we've seen that be effective with formaldehyde as well, haven't we, in the built environment? Slowly we're seeing that.
It's decreasing,
that
yeah.
Come
decreasing,
down.
Yeah, formaldehyde yeah. Decreasing. Generally.
Yeah, but still, interestingly, quite high up in the harm risk from the perspective of the work that you were involved in, Ben, still, even though we're still seeing it reduce steadily.
Still plenty of MDF in people's homes.
Yeah. Just because this, chronically it's still around.
Still around, yeah.
Yeah.
And we also see the old pollutants, because during renovation processes we release the new pollutants in the space. So PCB, for example, or any other that have been already removed, they are coming back. So, and then we have to remember that we are not able to toxicologically, you know, determine the harm from all the pollutants present. And this is what is important, that the harm estimation points out to the most important ones that need to be dealt at the same quickly. Some of them can be dealt by source control. Some of them can be dealt by source control, by target ventilation, for example, removing at a source and so on. So on. But some, in some cases, for the other pollutants, we cannot do anything but basically provide a level of ventilation for removing them, because we don't know that information on their toxicological impact. Yeah. So that is very important. That it's not that we can basically source control, do only source control. Mm. There must be a ventilation. And we had a project on that all time ago, Helsvent, I don't know whether anyone remembers that, in which we actually discussed that point, is that the source control, the ventilation is not panacea for everything, but you cannot like do only a source control. But this is where you should start.
Like, this stuff matters, ultimately. We're talking about things that cause harm. What kind of level of harm are we talking about, ultimately?
So indoor air pollution matters very much. The first thing to remember is no such thing as zero risk. So there has to be sort of some level of risk that we're comfortable with. And elsewhere in our lives, we tolerate risk, right? You cross a road, you go up some stairs, you eat certain things, and so on. Well, the harm evaluation that was done on indoor air contaminants suggests that it's somewhere between sort of tobacco smoking and transport.
Traffic injuries.
Traffic accident.
So I think it's this report is clearly showing. I mean, I think, of course, absolute measures are important. Sorry for dropping in, but I mean, it's important because it gives us the level of the potential benefit if we completely remove this. But it is impossible to remove risks.
Yeah,
from our lives.
I thought you were going to disagree with me on that.
I mean, the belts in the cars were introduced not because, you know, we will eliminate car accidents, right? So, and so this is an important thing to remember. So we are not the idea of harm, presenting the harm. It's not just to say, okay, this is more important than this is less important. It's just see the opportunities here, right? Yeah. And compare the level of harm that can be done by basically neglecting this aspect.
Yeah. I think you know, you have to remember that air is a hugely complex mix of stuff. There's with many of these contaminants, there is no zero risk threshold for these. They're always going to cause you harm, whatever level they appear at, and particularly with particulates. That's
yeah.
And then Buildings are dynamic. They change all the time. The way they're used, the way they react with the environment, causes different contaminants to be released at different rates at different times. And then we have limits of actually monitoring this stuff. monitoring some contaminants like formaldehyde over time, incredibly difficult to do. It's not something you can just slap a formaldehyde sensor in a home and work with that. You can't do that. And then finally, then, to sort of trade everything off, you've got impossible trade-offs. You're never going to get zero risks. But what we did look at was a small study. I looked at a series of American homes that complied with ASHRAE standard 62.2 and measured contaminant concentrations in there for some of the contaminants that we're interested in. And it suggested that if you complied with that, then you can bring the level of harm down so that it's way below transport. And that tells us that these standards matter a lot for population harm.
And I'm one for analogies, because I think it's, particularly with air quality, I think it's hard for people sometimes to grasp harm with something that's so invisible and potentially chronic and long-term. But you mentioned traffic accidents and harm from traffic. If you think about the complexity of managing traffic safety between weather changes and road layouts and roundabouts and no parking zones and speed limits and bumps and traffic calming measures and, you know, the policing, and it just, the list is endless because it's a complex subject. Mm-hmm. And enormous money and time is invested into every facet of this to just bring down. You're never going to eliminate the risk of crossing the road or jumping in a car, but we've learned over time through barriers and road markings and cat's eyes and lighting, and it goes on and on and on when you think about it, all about safety. Yep. And I get the sense we're nowhere near that with ventilation somehow, that we're still a fairly blunt instrument when it comes to source control and engineering controls, which we'll come on to shortly, are incredibly important, aren't they, for reducing overall risk?
Yeah, the objective is to reach an acceptable level of risk, and we need to play on all the cards we have to reach this acceptable level.
It's not up to us to do that, though. I mean, so we can get the risk down, right? But we're not going to make the decision of where acceptability lies, really. That should be a political decision, I think.
Absolutely.
I think we can say that you comply with standards and it's going to be much lower, but just how low you want to go should be a political decision.
Yeah.
But I want to play a devil's advocate here, because I think it's probably easier to regulate traffic through bumps and, you know, roundabouts than, you know, regulate the what people put in their homes. So, in a sense, we didn't find the solution to that. I think we believe that ventilation will solve all the problems, and may not, but I think we have to think about how effectively it can be done to at least reduce the risk, because we cannot, you know, it's like with smoking, right? We can put the big photograph on the package of cigarettes and then just say, well, this is how your lungs will look if you smoke, right? But I mean, it will not stop people from smoking. And the same, you know, how we do so that we reduce the potential risks and harm that is caused, and then there is basically a burden for the economy. Those people who get sick in houses, they will go to the hospital. Then there is a cost.
But to maybe throw that back at you a little bit, Pavel, suppose I can't stop somebody looking at their phone when they're crossing the street or driving like an idiot either.
Yes, exactly.
So there's always an element of personal choice
it's
in
not
risk,
that
I suppose, isn't it?
Sure.
It's also why PPE is at the bottom of the hierarchy. Yeah.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah.
Right.
So if we were throwing all our eggs in one basket at the moment and trying to have the biggest impact we could on indoor air quality at the moment, what's the one pollutant we should be concentrating on, do you think? I'm assuming from a harm perspective, you'd be saying.
You know, Ben, you just say it.
Yes, particulates.
Yeah.
That's what you focus on. Particles, particles, particles.
So
it's all order of magnitude more harmful in homes than the next most harmful contaminant. It's where you start straight away.
And perhaps explain to people why that's thus. What is it about particulate matter particularly that, because it's not... it's not just the sheer quantity. It's something about particulate matter, I guess, that's making this pollutant so harmful.
I think that's very difficult to say. So most of the studies of the relationship between exposure and harm from particulate matter isn't toxicologically based. Mm. So Pavel was talking about different tox methods earlier. And most of that comes from using mice over a couple of weeks of exposure. Mm. You know, so wrong model, wrong time frame. We're talking about chronic time frames, decades of harm. We're not really talking about acute effects very much today, because that's not what TN68 focuses on. Epidemiology just looks at the disease incidence in the population and relates that to concentrations that the surrounding population was exposed to. It doesn't say why. What we do know, though, from some of the contaminants, from the particulates that we look at indoors, particularly in the home, is that if you look at the particulates emitted by cooking, they're coated in polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which are themselves a carcinogen. So that makes sense. So the relationship is correlation. I think you would probably need to talk to a good medical doctor to explain true causation.
Yeah. Well, look. This is a podcast. You're not being held to account on a PhD thesis. So I'm only looking for best guesses here. And my understanding of particulate matter, at least, is that we tend to talk about particulate matter as if it's a thing, when in fact it's a number of chemicals and metals and polyaromatic hydrocarbons and products that we class as one substance. And perhaps the harmfulness of it is the collection of all that it is. And its potential to impact on the body. Would that be a good guess?
Yes. Probably. Not all Probably. Of them. Not all of which is
not
harmful.
All of them.
Yeah.
Right. Pavel and I live not too far from the coast.
Yeah.
I live on an island, and a baseline level of particulate matter in the UK is just sea salt.
Right.
And that's not going to. I can't imagine that will do you any harm.
But we have to remember that this action. I mean, if we start focusing on PM. And we really try to do something about it. It will be similar effect as, you know, overnight decision by commission to stop smoking in public spaces. So, and I think then we can maybe see something new, because we are living in a sort of like PM is also a variable. I mean, PM is also a dependent variable that actually is covering all the other potential problems that we cannot see. So it's very difficult to make any further action before we remove those big components, those big chunks. So when we removed the tobacco smoke, then we suddenly figure out that maybe there's something else, right? And then now when we start to focus on PM, maybe it's enough, maybe not.
Probably the least thought of piece of ventilation equipment in the home is the cooker hood. and by the sounds of listening to you folks, probably could be one of the most important pieces of equipment in the home.
Well, yeah, if you look at the French regulation, it's almost forbidden to put cooker hood now, because we need to have a larger flow rate in the kitchen that we can even turn even larger when we are cooking. But if we put, in addition to that, a cooker hood, then we will be penalized on the airtightness test, because the cooker hood are not airtight. I mean, external cooker hood, of course, I don't talk about recirculation once. Recirculation, you do whatever you want. So probably the cooker hood is, but when we have done some study on it, we found out that most cooker hood were totally unable to direct the flow towards them, and that with the ventilation system turned at its maximum level, we didn't have much less captation, because in fact, the basic cooker hood are not very good at capturing the flow inside them, and it's just get the average in the end. So cooker hood would probably be the most important, I would say, as long as they are well designed to actually cap something.
We've been talking about harm, but there's a very clever unit that's been used. It's an econometric. It's developed sort of 30 years ago. which is the Disability Adjusted Life Year, and it looks at a combination of years of life lived with disease and infirmity, and then it adds that to years of premature life lost. So how many years you die before you're expected to, and then puts that in a number. And that's why it's a good number, because it means you can compare different risks. I mean, indoor air pollution, exposure to it, and the consequences of being exposed to it are nothing like those from driving a car. We talked a lot about cars for an indoor air quality podcast.
But it's because you mentioned traffic, Ben, so that's your fault, Ben.
Yes. but it allows you to compare different risks and those trade-offs. And support cost-benefit analyses. You can put cost on them, you can put dollar sign, pound sign, euro sign, whatever you want in front of it. And that then enables you to set targets, or powers that be to set targets. I think that's just worth bringing up before we move on.
We touched upon the most important ones because of the harm analysis, but there will be groups of pollutants that we really need to think about that may not be captured by that, is that we talk about the semi-volatile organic compounds that may have sources in, you know, in the plastic materials and all that stuff that can be, present. We know about phthalates and their impact on the allergy and asthma outcomes. The other one would be flame retardants that are actually there for protecting us, but against the fire, but actually may be harmful for us. So there is a range of those pollutants that we really, again, we should not forget about those, even if we talk about the most important.
That's a really interesting point, the ones that are life-affecting but necessarily life-reducing.
Right,
so,
right.
So things like endocrine disruptors.
Yeah. Endocrine disruptor, And then these are the ones that, as I mentioned, PCB, for example, that is reappearance because of the retrofit actions that are taken. And then, of course, ozone. We have to discuss also about ozone. This is something that we really need to better understand, that ozone itself may not be a pollutant that causes harm in homes, although it has been in the first analysis. That could be maybe a marker of the potential products that it can generate. So that is something that we have to remember. And those products can be during our activities. So, for example, our grandmas usually open windows when they were cleaning the house. Today, we don't open window when we use a lot of chemicals to basically clean the house and make them smell nice and fresh, but these compounds usually will react with ozone and produce toxic compounds at very high levels at the time when we do this activity. So that is the episodic exposure, but then it may have consequences.
This is where the chemists become important. It's outside of my domain, but the thing with ozone is a lot of it ends up as formaldehyde, which is also dangerous.
Right. And again,
it really matters.
Formaldehyde also.
Yeah. So we go back to transport. Then, if we can get rid of the ozone from the burning of fossil fuels, then we'll be doing ourselves a favour.
So maybe that's something that can be looked at in the future. It's not just the Dalys; it's the potential for life impacting. Exactly. Exposure to stuff that doesn't necessarily translate into disabilities or early death, but also the stuff that may create the chemistry in the environment that may lead to some of those other ones.
Right. What we're interested in is the contaminant that causes harm, and it may be that we're either double counting or we're not looking at the right thing. Right. That's what it is. It's all going to end up as a DALY.
But if we come back to the endocrine disruptor, that's how we call it. Yeah, it's. We found out in France that it was some kind of something we can market. Marketing with endocrine disruptor was much easier than for radon, for example. We have got a huge demand on measurement in endocrine disruptor. Why would they've done it with radon? It seems that some topic better are easier to explain or to touch the people with. And it's good when we find one because it's a foot on the door, I call it. Okay, you want that, but remember, there is also this, and this that are important. And I think those new pollutants that are easier to, how to put it, how to, easier to make the general opinion be aware of it, there are great opportunity to actually push forward indoor air quality. And I think we need to find them, those pollutants that are easier to market.
Because they're the door wedges that open the door, keep the door open for the other conversations.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Radon, you're absolutely right, is an absolutely classic example of people just don't want to know.
Yeah.
We've been trying for years.
Exactly.
I say it's the slam dunkiest of dunky air quality parameters out there. We know where it comes from. It can't be mistaken for anything else. We know the harm that it causes. We've got a straight line to that.
Mm. Yet you can't measure it.
It's
cheap to measure.
It's a $20 sensor, isn't it?
You can't give a test away.
Mm. Yeah.
And is there something in that? I mean, is there something that we should comment on when it comes to the leveraging this in the psyche of the general population? You know, we've been talking about stuff that's very familiar to us, but is completely foreign language to most people. How do we get this to resonate? This is, as you said, Ben, this is important. This has health impacts that are at least comparable to things that we know we should be concentrating on, like smoking and traffic deaths and alcoholism. Yet we've got to find a way to get this to resonate somehow. And it seems to me that there's a gap there somehow.
Is this a perception risk then, do you think?
Do you think
people know and don't do anything?
I think there are several steps. First step is just to make people aware of that. Mm. Today, most people are not even aware that those risks exist. So they move to a house and they believe that everything is new or maybe everything is fine. And this is probably may not be true.
I think DALI are a great tool to help regulation makers take decision. Mm-hmm. But it's not a good tool for people because they don't care living one year less. But if it will affect their everyday life, then they will make decision to change it. So
it's interesting you say that. The smoking was always presented in terms of DALIs. We coined a term in England where every cigarette cost you 7 minutes of your life.
Mm.
People understood that an action had a long-term impact, and that's one of the ways we got it to resonate. But we haven't been able to capture that with air quality somehow.
Mm.
Well, maybe we should say it like that.
Why not? But I think people are becoming, so this is a good segue to the controls. I think that people are becoming interested in the sort of traffic light systems that they've got on their phones. Check the weather, maybe someone will look at the air quality index. People already check the pollen index if they're hay fever sufferers. Right, but I think
But you've just touched on, we're just about to jump off air quality, but you've just mentioned a bioaerosol, and we probably, if we're talking about the residential set, it would be remiss for us not to talk about mold and mold spores and allergies and so on. These are life impacting, we know very much so. I think number six on your list or something in the harm thing in the recent work, but it's still 40% of European homes have some form of damp and mold in them. We know this is a perceived, we understand it has some impacts on mental health as well that we don't fully understand. I don't know if DALIs picks up mental health impacts, for example.
Potentially. But I need to clarify something. The work that we, TN68 covers, occurs over decades. It's things that occur much later on after continued exposure over periods of time is known as a chronic exposure. And that's what TN68 is dealing with. Over the short time, things that lead to hay fever, asthma attacks, and so on that may occur very rapidly after being exposed to something of what's known as acute effects. And I think we have to be very careful not to confuse the two. So certainly the pollen is an acute effect and not a chronic effect, as far as I understand it.
Yeah, but the acute effects are easier to communicate on because if we say to people, okay, if you remove the mold in your house, if you put a ventilation so that there is no more mold, then the asthma crisis of your kids will decrease. This is something. And if you improve the ventilation of your bedroom, then you will sleep better, maybe.
Yes.
This is something that would make people act But if you just told them, okay, well, you may lose 1 year of your life, but it's mostly due to external traffic, they won't change most of it.
Those who have sick children or are sick, basically, they will know and they will act.
Yeah.
But most of us that we don't know, probably we don't care, or maybe we don't know. So the point is that very often we really don't know. So we know when we go to the supermarket, I mean, we put the bell, I mean, going back to the to the car analogy, is that we put the belts of buckle up, not, of course, because we will pay the ticket, right, if we don't, but I mean, also to protect ourselves. After some time, we realize that this is actually life-saving, but if I speed up, maybe it will not help, right? So it is always my decision, but I'm aware of what I do. In many cases, in homes, we users or occupants of buildings, we are not aware of the consequences of the actions that we take. Yeah. And I think there's extremely important role just to educate us on that point.
It's not for nothing that air pollution is known as the invisible killer.
Yeah, that is what I was driving at.
It's a great catchphrase, isn't it, really? Yeah.
And I think perhaps the missing link for people is they haven't quite joined the dots between... I think everybody recognises that air pollution has a harm associated with it, but they haven't necessarily linked the fact that ventilation can reduce pollution in the home that's likely to cause a harm. And I think... That's why we see so many failures of ventilation systems. People aren't associating it with a health benefit that they should. And I don't know why, but they were onto control strategies, really. We've kind of touched on them a little bit with air quality, and we've talked about the hierarchies of control. There are two main tranches, aren't there, really? There's the source control element of this, the elimination and substitution of these hazards out of the spaces where we can. But beyond that, then we're into engineering controls mostly, aren't we? Which is where we're talking about ventilation. What's your sense in the 10 years since TN68 was written, how ventilation has moved on? What have we learned in the last decade around ventilation and standards and the quality of systems out there? I know this is something you've looked at a lot, Valerie. Yeah.
Well,
we'll leave it to Valerie.
Just relax for 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so one thing we have learned is that the ventilation usually failed to be properly installed. And maybe 10 years ago, we are assuming that if there was a ventilation system, it was working properly. While we have realized since then that usually it's not designed properly, it's not installed properly, it's not maintained properly, so at the end it does not provide the flow rate that it's supposed to provide. And so we cannot move on with regulation, we cannot decide what would be the right flow rate as long as we don't have ventilation systems that do actually provide the flow rate. So maybe one thing that is really stressed, and also again, it's in the PBD new directive, European directive. We need to do the inspection of ventilation system, and we need to do that on a regular basis to check that it actually provides the flow rate it's supposed to provide within the space and not through leakage of ductwork or things like that. So that was thing we have learned, I think, and. Things that are moving on now is a new way of making regulation. We have been very prescriptive for ever, I would say, regarding regulation, saying, okay, you need to put that flow rate. But this is no longer working because this is not energy efficient and this is not indoor air quality efficient. What we need is first to have only needed flow rate, so to limit the sources. And we need this flow rate to come at the right place at the right moment. To be efficient, it needs to come when it's needed, where it's needed. And we need for that regulations that are able to give credits to those systems that provide the right flow rate at the right place. So we no longer need regulations that just say provide whatever, 10 liters per second per person. we need to say that this need to be provided actually when according to the population in the room. So we no longer need to say that. We need to say, okay, you need to remain below 1,000 ppm of CO2, maybe, if you want to control the ventilation system according to the occupation, you can use CO2 as a thruster, 90% of the time, for example. So we need performance-based regulation and no longer only prescriptive regulation. And the TN was actually stressing that already 10 years ago. It has not changed a lot in the last 10 years, but this is changing now. I think that those performance-based regulation are coming into force in Belgium, in France, in Spain, and also in the European standards 16798-1.
To play devil's advocate here, if we've been so poor so far at getting even the basics right of saying, I want half an air change an hour in this room, or 10 litres a second per person, or half an air change an hour in a residential setting, and every time we go and look at it, we're nowhere near. What's different now with a prescriptive or performance-based standard, with additional complexity that comes with that? Are we moving too fast? Should we have been able to say we can do the basics first before moving on to systems where we, you know, to unpack whether a fan is doing what it should do, I can go and measure the fan and see if it's doing what it should do. If I now need to understand if a sensor's control algorithm is correct or not, or what, whether the outcome that I saw in a room was because of the sources or because of the ventilation system, that's a complicated world, I guess. So as a devil's advocate, are you comfortable moving into this kind of performance-based world with the history that we have of the prescriptive world?
Well, I think this is the opportunity for those. Well, those smarter systems will be more expensive, basically. There will be less. We've got very cheap system right now in most countries, I would say. Extract-only system is not expensive. Giving some smartness in those system will make them more expensive. And this is also the opportunity to go further and to include the auto control in the system. And I think, well, the way we are doing it in France for the performance-based regulation is that they have to justify that the system is performing well, but they have also to justify how we will inspect them. What is the inspection protocol? How can we check that it's actually working? So the system needs to be synced at the same time with the inspection protocol and how we can check it. And also, hopefully, with some kind of auto-control to make sure that the performance are still running after year. So I see the performance, the new regulation, as an opportunity for the smart system to also include inspection in it that we are failing to include in cheap system because it would just be too expensive.
Yeah.
I think that I'm afraid that I have to say it, that we are probably not near where we would like to be with ventilation. To be honest, even 10 years, even 20 years ago, we are in the same situation. I think that there has been some development in ventilation, but I think it was mainly driven by the energy and not by the other aspects. Ventilation is sort of invisible healer. So you have like air pollution is invisible killer. Here's invisible healer. So he provided so to dilute those invisible pollutants, right? So so no one is probably requiring certification. Anyone can install it because it's really, no one will see whether it's working or not working, right? So if I make an analogy to water system, you know, it's just like, if you have a plumbing without certification, so then if you open the for the water, then it's no water coming, right? Or very little dripping just only. So would you be upset? Of course you would be upset. And if you try to flush your toilet, it's not going, you would be also upset. And here we have no method to check whether this is what air is dripping. and whether we can remove the air from the. And then I think what Valerie was saying is actually everything that is problem of the ventilation today is that basically there is no certification for, there's no certification for installing it. There is no ways of checking whether they work, even for the energy point of view properly, not even mentioning for the performance based for the pollutants. I just want to remind you that when the report from the Netherlands was published, I think it was 2016 or 2017, when they found out that most of the ventilation systems in Netherlands were just closed down by the users because either they were noisy or there was a lot of draft or there was some smell coming from them. And that's so it was terrible because people didn't want to have it. Mm-hmm. But it was not because of the mistakes that were made, that they are not properly implemented. So I think before we go to the performance base, let's do the basics. Let's make them operate as they should, and then we can add on top of it. And just coming back to cooker hoods, I mean, it's really in the modern energy efficient building, you know, the amount of air that is going through the cooker hood is reduced because of the energy performance, not even considering the aspect of the removal of the pollutants. So,
I know, for example, Passive House Association don't want exhausting to atmosphere.
That's exactly the point.
Because of the amount of, which is, you know, perhaps a mistake, I would argue, on their part. I'm not sure.
Yeah, you need to have a makeup air. Effective.
Yeah, because it's not going to draw it through through infiltration.
So I mean, all of that was what Valerie was saying is really true, and I think the basic things are really needed and decisions. And I don't know if anyone is ready to make those decisions, but I think this is where we would really have a change, major change.
One of the problems we've had with ventilation over the years is we've just assumed because a standard had existed that the supply chain would put it in according to that standard. Mm. There was just this blind assumption, if I asked for a fan to be put in a bathroom, that magically the supply chain would understand the requirements and make sure that that fan was not just be paid for wiring a fan up. The interesting thing about performance-driven systems is they change the narrative around what a good outcome is. Because with a prescriptive system, the outcome is, does it exist, and is there a bit of paper that said it complied with a reg at some point, a regulation at some point? Whereas with a performance-based system, the framing is completely different. You're putting this in for an outcome, not for a prescription. And I think that change in framing helps the conversation. So perhaps downstream at a user end, the expectation is that this thing is automated and will deliver an outcome in the same way a thermostat should deliver thermal comfort. The expectation is perhaps that a ventilation system that's based on performance will deliver an air quality outcome, and people be more attuned to that, you know?
And be more informed also. I think those systems, those smart systems, are the opportunity to have the information on your phone. How is the indoor air quality in the bedroom? How is the indoor air quality in the... And that the system can actually act on it and show it directly.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, Simon said, that there are companies who are doing the right things. They've got great products. Mm. And we're not going to sell those today, but they definitely exist. But the kids who are dying of asthma attacks and so on aren't in great homes. They're in social homes. Mm. They're in low-cost rent homes. And although the landlords are required to be accountable for those homes, ultimately, they're not, and it's not enforced. And you would know, going, you've seen this. You have more experience than we do on this, seeing it firsthand most days, I assume.
Yeah. Well, I think what's changing is that there is now an expectation at a regulator level in many countries that ventilation hasn't been performing, and we now need mechanisms to check that it's performing. So we've seen in France and Belgium and Ireland and other countries starting to introduce independent inspection of ventilation systems, something that when this document was written didn't exist anywhere at that point. So I think that's been a significant change, and you can't manage what you don't measure ultimately. And I think we're at least there now. We're starting to get to a point where there's a recognition that success isn't the existence of a thing on a wall. It's at least at the point that it was installed, was it capable of achieving a prescriptive number for whatever use that is. And interestingly, in countries that are more advanced with demand-based systems, there's still that prescriptive check of that system to make sure that it's performing in line with the manufacturer's guidance or an agreement or whatever determines its performance. So I think we've got there at least, but it's not widespread yet. We don't have the policing in many countries to back it up. But I think it's at least a step forward in the right direction. And you've seen that as well, haven't you, Valerie, over the last 5 years. I think there's been steady improvement, at least across Europe, to inspect these systems.
Right. At least for residential buildings.
Yeah.
But this is a topic today. For non-residential buildings, we still have some work to do. But for residential buildings, there are really big improvements. Big improvement.
And particularly in Europe, where we're from anyway, at least, the vast majority of the stock exists today. So we're talking about older buildings and buildings that perhaps complied with the previous regulations and are not going to be obliged to be rechecked. And so there is going to be the vast majority of the population in more established parts of the world are going to be living for the next 30 or 40 years in homes that aren't going to get that check necessarily. And that's a challenge, I think.
It is. And I think that every subsidy is given for energy performance to change the house or energy performance to check that the indoor environment quality is still guarantees with the change that will be done regarding the energy performance. And we are not that yet. We've got some label in France that now do impose that if you want to get the subsidies on your energy refurbishment, then you need to check at the end the ventilation system and do something for the air renewal in your home. But this is a minority, really, and most of windows are changed and air tightness down without caring at all on ventilation system, and this is a big issue.
I always think what Martin Liddiment used to say. Martin Liddiment used to run the air filtration ventilation system back in the day. And he looks back at these old homes, which are drafty, leaky, fireplaces open, suspended timber floors, plenty of air going through them, right? But they were freezing cold. And he posed the devil's advocate question, maybe they're just okay as they are. And the problem comes, of course, when we start to seal them up and think about them and operate them in the modern way.
I think you're absolutely correct, Ben. I mean, and that is the big challenge of this century, is the fact that these buildings need significant alteration because we don't live in that world where we've got an abundance of fuel sources.
Of cheap, clean energy.
Exactly. Right. So we have that challenge. And our expectations have changed as well. You know, nobody expects to wake up in a bedroom with ice on the inside of the window.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
which is why no one wants to air there when their houses too, I suppose.
And our requirements in terms of comfort are changing. And the more we get, the more we want. Also, if you can look at some countries where they don't have heating system in a room and they are perfectly okay. I think of New Zealand, for example. They are used not to heat the bedroom. They've got moisture problem, etc. But it's okay in terms of comfort. Us as European, we are not used to have cold houses. So now everybody wants to have at least 90 degrees or 20 degrees in his houses in the winter, everywhere in the houses. And if we want that, if we want the thermal comforts, then we need the energy limitation, and then we need to build tight and ventilate.
Okay, right, there we go.
Is there anything on control strategies we haven't touched on that you'd like to, so we touched on demand control ventilation, we've touched on... The one question I did have in here was around... with all that we've learnt about air quality, that old chestnut of are the prescriptive numbers that are there in the residential setting adequate or not still? So generally speaking, across the residential regulatory horizon, we're in and around half an air change an hour in the residential space. As we sit here today, do we think that's enough? And if it's not, what should we be thinking about? Because that has direct implications on energy in the residential stock. So what are your thoughts on that? As we sit here today with what we've learned from when this was written, where we sit here today in the energy horizon, what's your perspective?
Well, first of all, I think we've been discussing and complaining about ventilation systems, not about ventilation. So I think the listeners to the podcast should understand that we are not saying that ventilation should not be done. It actually, when it's done properly, it will provide benefits. So I think this is what is important here. Well, I think before pandemic and before the new studies which we published recently, this half change per hour, it was pretty good estimate of what it should be. And if my recollection is correct, that has been determined based on the humidity control and house dust mite in most of the cases, which cannot be all the time, of course, because of the humidity will change outside anyway. So, but anyway, that was just sort of like an attempt to do that. And it worked very well. And then in the Halsven project that that I was mentioning earlier, we said that if you control all the pollutants that are on the WHO list, you can go down to 4 liters per second per person, basically, as a base ventilation. It is very, very low, but I mean achievable in a sense if you do the proper source control. And again, it means that there must be some ventilation. But the new research on sleep quality suggests that probably we should go up with the ventilation. And maybe to 1 change per hour, maybe to 0.7 or maybe 0.8. This is what we need to know. But it turns out that we need to revise the prescriptive numbers because of that particular environment in our homes where we spend third of our lifetime, actually. Now, I mean, if we sleep in a hotel, no. But, I mean, basically, this is where we spend, 8 hours a day. So it is significant, of a significant importance. So this is where we should focus. And what I'm saying this is that maybe the total ventilation for the house will not have to change. We will probably have to use a smart system to better direct the air, to provide that ventilation to bedroom, that higher ventilation bedroom, without changing the total amount of the ventilation for the entire home. So it is not that suddenly it is revolutionary that all the homes will have to have upgraded, fans, ducting, and so on. It may be the smart way of redirecting the flows to different locations, depending on where it's needed at the time when there are people, could be a solution to that. So I think we need to revising that probably. This is from that point of view if we talk about prescriptive, right, approach, because this is a different approach that we were talking earlier, right, is a hum. Mm. So it's a slightly different way of thinking about this, right?
I think there is no yes or no answer to the question, is it enough flow rate or not? It depends on, well, we won't provide a ventilation that is absolutely healthy for everybody, for 100% of people, because we don't control the source, we don't know the people. So we need to define what is acceptable. What is acceptable indoor air quality in rooms. And this acceptable indoor air quality will depend on the objective you have for the room. You won't put the same flow rate in a storage room where nobody goes or maybe 5 minutes a day. That same objective for bedrooms where you will sleep, so you will focus on the quality of your sleep. But you don't need to focus on the quality of the sleep in the living room. You need to focus on something else. In the bathroom, maybe the top priority will not be the quality of sleep, neither the exposition to pollutant, but the humidity where you don't want to have moisture development. So in fact, we need to rethink those flow rate in what are the objectives for each room, and then what are the level we want, what are the indicator that we will need to check to meet this objective, and what are the threshold. And when you do this work of trying to find indicators and threshold for the room according to that objective, you find out that you get another problem, is to define what is acceptable in terms of thresholds. Because if we start to say, okay, what is the acceptable level of formaldehyde, for example, in Berlin, you will have people saying, oh, this is this. Well, no, we need to go lower and we need to go even lower. And then, okay, so let's make the design. We need to make some modeling and simulation. So we need input scenario. What are the input scenarios that we should use? And then you will have people say, okay, we need to be on the safe side and take this level of emission, and other people on the safe side, on this side. And then what we find out during this work in France is that we were absolutely unable to get something that was acceptably accepted as acceptable. So we said, okay, we will just check how the system perform right now, the prescriptive-based system, and we will put the threshold in line that. Maybe it's too much, maybe it's not enough, but we are not able right now to say what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. So let's assume that in the building where those systems are working, it's not that bad. We don't see mold growth. The level of radon is okay. The comfort is maybe okay. Well, at least people do not complain. So we will put the threshold in line of how the prescriptive system works. And this is how we will define what is acceptable. So I would say that there is no yes, no answer to your questions, because, yeah, we need more data, more monitoring, and more, well, I would say objective on which we can agree before we can say what is acceptable or not.
In a way, today what we do is basically divide the total ventilation by square meter. So if you have a large living room, you will have more ventilation in the living room than in a small bedroom, right? Which maybe this is where we have to think about how we do this.
Yeah.
There's a good reason for that.
No, we don't do that in France. We do it according to the number of room.
Ashra has a baseline ventilation that's
per
square meter.
Yeah, but there's a baseline. But these baselines are, again, don't want to, the baselines is low.
Well, welcome to regulations. You know, they regulations don't have the luxury of saying, well, we don't have all the information yet. They've got to come up with a number that's applicable to a typical building in a typical scenario. And there will always be yeses and buts and nos and maybes and outliers and edge cases. But somebody at some point has got to draw a line in a document and says, this is where we think our buildings need to be above in order to raise the floor or improve standards. And like you say, we're in the luxury position of not having to come up with that number, but somebody does somewhere. And at the moment it's 0.3 litres a second per square metre in the UK and Ireland and many countries, which is equivalent to half an air change an hour. Awesome. And you have 4 litres a second per person, typically based on people, which is your occupancy driven. And largely you come out with a result. The interesting question is that enough in the current environment? And I think it's a resounding, we're not sure.
To be fair, we haven't done the harm evaluation for European homes. We've done it for American homes, done it for the American for the ASHRAE standard. That's another thing to do on the list, and a jolly good thing to put on the list.
Yeah.
There's a plenty of air. I mean, if you take a house, 100 square meters, 250 cubic meters, four persons occupying it, you end up with more probably 30 cubic meter per hour per person, which is quite a lot. actually. It's the same as in the office.
Well, let's look, you know, I think if you take good outcomes in the built environment, we largely know if you build homes to code and the ventilation systems perform, then the outcomes are generally good. On the whole, like the challenge we have often is that, you know, it kind of brings us onto policies and standards, is that we don't get there regularly enough. As you said, Valerie, when we go to check, we're just not getting to those minimums. But my experience generally is if I go into a passive house and it's doing 0.3 air changes per hour, or I go into a regulation code home in the UK with a MVHR system in or a demand control system in, the air quality is fine. Like, you know, we're crossing T's and dotting I's at that point. I think it's very incremental improvements. The challenge is the buildings that are nowhere near it or have got fundamentally flawed approaches to the ventilation in those properties. That's where the low-hanging fruit is.
That's correct, but also
with abnormal behaviours. It's not always the fault of the ventilation system. Sorry.
But this is why the harm analysis helps us a lot, because what we are talking about is long exposure, because, you know, if you think about the time that we spend in homes compared with all the other environments is significant, and then large, probably dose will increase. So even a small amount of the pollutants in the end may increase your risk of developing certain diseases. And this is this invisible health risk that we, maybe this is not a good analogy, but as you know, when I start to smoke, for example, as a 10-year-old, I'm not thinking about the cancer that I may get in 30 years because of also other exposures. But if I don't start smoking, my risk will be much lower, even though I get the other exposures. So this is exactly the point where we can identify those really most important pollutants that we really need to do something about, and the harm analysis will help a lot. It's helping a lot in that process.
Do you have an opinion on ventilation's job in a residential setting for infection control? Let's start there, because I'd like to come on to air cleaners and equivalent ventilation, because we have this discussion in the non-residential setting all the time, even there it's not a black and white scenario. There are levels of intervention and its effectiveness. But what's your perspective on the purpose of ventilation in a residential setting for reduction of infection?
I think that in the general case, where you do not know that somebody is exposed, it's not going to do a whole lot given our behaviours. You know, we hug, we kiss, we sit close, and it's not going to mitigate against that transmission risk. But it has a very, very important case, a role when somebody is vulnerable. And in the event of there being an outbreak of something that could be potentially harmful to them, they want to semi-isolate or isolate themselves in a part of the home, then it can be useful then. It can be useful once somebody is infected and they want to isolate themselves in a space that can play a very important role then too.
But it's difficult to make it mandatory that dwelling should be epidemic ready. I mean, we are talking about huge flow rates. So, I mean, this is more like some systems that can be added in case of you need to isolate someone, like a fan on the windows or something. But
is that perspective coloured by our recent experience from the pandemic we had? I mean, we got away with it this time, although it was an infectious disease. It was relatively low on the harm scale. If that had been a different disease where it was maybe less infectious but significantly more harmful, would we be taking a different perspective about ventilation in our homes, that actually I need to be able to, for my family's safety, have a zone in the home that can be protected or something? You know, are we coloured by our, or is that just an unreasonable expectation that at some point as a global community we're going to be faced with a disease that we would have wished we'd made some choices on infection control in homes?
I think if we were really needing it, if we've got one room, then we can always put a fan on the windows that will adjust to the windows to make it overpressurized, underpressurized if needed. I think designing dwellings so that we can isolate someone is a lot, I would say. It would cost a lot, and it's not that... Yeah.
What do you do in a bedsit in a studio apartment? What do you do?
That's not
so straightforward. But I think in a large home, maybe with a spare room, then it can be done.
Yeah. I would also go and sleep with my dog in the garden, you know.
Put a tent in the garden and that you will be just fine. Yeah.
But I think the general consensus is then that the place of residential ventilation, we're not looking at it from an infection risk like we would do with 241, for example, in exactly the same way. It's not there primarily to protect us as an engineering control for infection.
I think you're talking about an outlying event, right? And that would come under the same category as, say, wildfires too. And in which case, you probably don't want your ventilation. That's one of those incidences where you might just turn it off and think and install some air cleaning and isolate yourself to one room in the house and drink plenty of fluids.
Yeah, I would more willingly make a room wildfire ready, a dwelling wildfire ready, or any explosion, outdoor explosion ready, than ready for pandemic. I think it would make more sense actually to be able to shut off the ventilation system if the outdoor pollution is so high that you need to isolate and shut off, and maybe use air cleaning or something to keep it at an acceptable level.
What a great segue onto my next question, then. Thank you. I often describe ventilation as pillars, and we have general ventilation as a primary pillar. We have exhaust ventilation as a primary pillar. Mm. We have purge, you know, our ability to throw a home open to the environment. But there is this fourth pillar that seems to be developing in ventilation, and that's this recirculation of existing air in a space and cleaning it. Do you see that approach, that pillar of ventilating in a residential setting, has a place, do you think? I mean, I guess with the wildfire smokes and things we've seen in North America, certainly, but generally, like, do we think that might become more of a thing, this equivalent air change rate that you introduce a certain amount of recirculation and filtration to make up?
So ventilation provides dilution. This provides dilution, but without bringing air in from outside. Yeah. So we call it an equivalent to ventilation. And yes, I certainly see it having a role. If you don't have a cooker hood in a home, you don't want to install a cooker hood in your home, then it can do a very good job. If you've got a vulnerable person, an asthmatic, then it can do a very good job.
Like in all the other environments, I mean, if we know the solution that is working at the same level of efficiency as ventilation, why not using this solution? And then does it mean that we have to reduce the ventilation? Maybe we can keep it as it is, maybe we can supplement ventilation.
The advantage
rather than just thinking about that, oh, here we can save so much ventilation. I mean, it's an additional add-on to further improve the environment. So I think we should think in that term.
I'd just quickly add that it's a more efficient way of dealing with it, because you don't have to provide additional heating or cooling to right. change the properties of the air you're bringing into the space.
But I think, I really believe that air cleaning is an indoor air quality management procedure. But
isn't that what ventilation is, though?
Ventilation, well,
I mean,
I would say,
ventilation.
Yeah. In what we do in 16798-1 is what we try to say, okay, indoor air quality management procedure, what they are. There is a source control, it's one. Mm. There is a ventilation, it's another one. And there is air cleaning, which is another one. Mm-hmm. The three of them goes together. One cannot replace all
Should
the other,
not.
But it will supplement. You decrease the source, then you may be able to decrease the ventilation level. You induce some air, you put some air cleaning, then you may be able, but it doesn't mean that they all go together. One cannot replace the others. So you need to, and I think that for particulate matter or aerosol contaminants and infected aerosols, this is very good, and it's an incredibly good supplement to the ventilation system.
In another wonderful segue into one of the questions I wanted to ask you.
It's almost like we've been primed.
I know, yeah. It's almost like I've got a list of questions to go through. Where are we with air cleaners and standards and regulations? Because we've just spent a bit of time talking about our fairly poor ability to hit the standards with standard ventilation. We weren't even talking about air cleaners, really, when TN68 was being developed. Not at the level we are now.
No.
So what does that landscape look like at the moment from a quality control, regulation, standard perspective?
Can I just talk about what they do and don't do? Then these guys can answer your question.
Yeah, do, please. Right? Yeah.
So the vast majority of air cleaners on the market have a filter in them that remove particulates, including aerosols. Then there are another type that might claim to remove a certain amount of gaseous pollutants, but often they add in things that are equally as more nasty than those that they remove. And then there might be others that use ultraviolet light to provide to remove bacteria and other pathogens. So it really does depend on what they do. I mean, in that context, they can.
Well, I mean, air cleaners, it's not air cleaners, just uncleaners, because we are talking about the different types of air cleaning process. So that we will be talking about a particle removal, gaseous pollutants removal, and then also particles that will kill the microbiota, I mean, pathogens or something like that. So then, and they would be using, some of them, they may use the similar principles, and some of them may use different principles. So it's not like one solution that will solve everything.
Well,
and with the standardization, I think we are really good in case of the particle filtration. And I think here that is a lot that we can basically use it, and we know that it's effective, right? But when it comes to gaseous pollutants removal, that is really not very well developed. There is a new standard on the sensory perception of the air quality, of the air that is cleaned by the air cleaners from the gaseous pollutants. But basically, we don't know what type of pollutants we need to use. For checking their performance. Sometimes there are different pollutants that are used in different guidelines or standards that are locally developed in the different countries. So we don't have a standard method, and we really don't know how they perform in the actual environment. So it's one way to put the air cleaner in the laboratory and test, it removes so much of the pollutants, but if you put it in an environment, it may be performing completely differently. So I think it is still a long way to go with the gaseous with the air cleaners for the gaseous pollutants or the gas phase air cleaners. So then, but there is a lot of opportunity as well. And then, if we know that it has to be formaldehyde removed, for example, from your harm analysis van and your group, so then we just design it to remove formaldehyde, right? We keep the ventilation unchanged, we design. If it's PM2.5, we just use the filters, right? Or HEPA, or maybe high efficiency filters, not necessarily HEPA, and so on and so on. So at least we can improve more effectively than just by using the ventilation, right?
And it seems fairly straightforward to me in the sense that we've largely agreed that PM2.5 or microfine particles are a significant source of harm. We've got a technology that we understand very well can very effectively remove those particulates from the air. So that it seems like there's a straight line between a problem and a solution. The question is, as of today, if people want to go and buy those solutions, do the standards and regulations exist for them? Broadly,
to be able to get a good outcome or understand the kind of outcome that they're going to get, would you say? No,
not in Europe. I think there is American standards dealing with the CADR and the performance of air cleaning systems. European standards are not quite there yet, but I think the general knowledge agree to say, okay, air cleaning with the filters for particulate matter, so HEPA or EPM1, are working well and are safe, I would say. UV is probably working well. The rest of it, well, let's be cautious for now.
Yeah.
Well, even, I mean, we have to be very, very careful in our conclusions here. And I don't want to say anything opposite to the fact that the filters will be very effective. We have to also talk about electrostatic air cleaning, which is extremely important. But there is possibility of generating ozone, but we have to think about, there are solutions that basically minimize that. But if PM, as we discussed in the first part of our podcast, and we have to remember, is the proxy for all the other types of pollutants. So by removing PM, we'll probably not remove all the other pollutants. So they will accumulate on a filter, and then under certain circumstances will be just going back to the air because of the normal chemistry or physical chemistry processes. Mm-hmm. So it's not that we will remove PM2.5 and then we will just also remove all the other pollutants. So we need to think about those other pollutants. But certainly for specific, if these are particles truly like, for example, for pathogens, I mean, they will be very effective because we know that they will be removing pathogens. And we are now working on a paper, and the paper is hopefully will be soon published, which we clearly show that if you talk about air cleaner that remove gases, also gas phase polar, volatile organic compounds, your cleaner delivery rate, so this equivalent ventilation that is related to the efficiency of removal of the pollutants will change. And some pollutants will be zero, some pollutants will be 50, some pollutants will be 60. And really, you need to target this for the specific pollutants. So if you go to the... So I think the public does not know. If you go to the shop and you buy the air cleaner, which is the charcoal maybe, or activated charcoal, or any other type, I don't want to... So then, and then it says it's cleaner delivery rate of 1 air change per hour. So maybe 2 or 10 air changes per hour. That has been determined for a specific pollutant. It doesn't mean that it will work for any other pollutant than that specific pollutant. So, yeah. And this is really the way where the harm analysis is important, because we can basically target them for specific pollutants. And also, we need to really start thinking that we need to provide this information.
Yeah.
So connect makes connections.
And I think you said something very important about the proxy at the beginning, and we may apply it also to CO2. We have seen CO2 removal systems that were removing CO2. That seems to be the great solution for improving the sleeping quality in bedrooms, but that's totally wrong. I mean, the CO2 is just a proxy for a lot of other pollutants. That those are the ones that cause the sleep
CO2
disruption.
CO2 isn't a pollutant.
Yeah. Right. And so,
in most circumstances.
Yeah. So in fact, you need not to mix causality and correlation again.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, as we were saying for PM, maybe the PM itself, what will be removed by the filter, is not the problem. And maybe there was something else around it that is the problem. And so indeed, in this matter, we need to be very careful what we remove, not to, and make sure we remove everything that is a problem and not just one part of the problem.
But I assume what you're saying about filtration as an air cleaning solution is that it's a non-additive process, that we're not creating additional chemistry by removing things from the air. It's a thing collector. So it's a zero harm game from that perspective. We may not get the outcomes we necessarily thought we were going to get, but I'm imagining the unintended consequences are fairly limited.
That has been discussed a lot during pandemic, and towards the end of pandemic, there was the paper published, or at least the webinar made, in which, you know, debate was on the efficiency of different air cleaning solutions for removing of pathogens. And there was a debate on how much, for example, UV will remove pathogens and at the same time create the maybe ultrafine particles or whatever, any other toxic pollutants that will kill people. I mean, so where is the balance here, right? So, yeah. So, and I think this debate is very important, and it should be taking place, but we should not think about, again, there's no one, as Valerie said, there is no one solution. And I think we should be thinking in terms of minimizing the risks of our exposures by efficient use of all the three sort of pillars for the reducing exposure, which is the source control as a first action and the most effective, secondly ventilation, and then air cleaning if the ventilation may not work for everything.
Yeah, no, that's, I think, very wise and seems like a logical approach. You know, ultimately, it's back to hierarchies of controls,
exactly.
Fundamentally, isn't it?
Which, right.
You know. It's a logical process.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it so hard, do you think, to pin down thresholds and standards for things like air quality? Every time we look out at the and scan the horizon of various different thresholds, that they're a constantly moving feast of different numbers measured through different timescales. It's enormously complex, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It's... In fact, there are three things that are complex. First, find the right criteria. When I talk about criteria, this is it PM, formaldehyde, CO2, whatever. First, find it. Once you've got your criteria, which indicator do you use? Do you use the average over 1 day, over 1 week, over 1 year? Do you use the peak value? Do you use the maximum over 1 hour, the time? I mean, so the criteria is one thing. The second thing is to find the indicator. And once you've got the indicator, what is the threshold value for this indicator? And here, what do you like? Do you want? Do you want that? Well, it won't affect 99% of the population. It won't affect 90% of the population. It should not affect more than 60% of the population. And so those are all decisions to be taken by policymakers. But this is not easy because the more safety you want, the more energy use you will have usually. So,
yeah.
It's very difficult to define air quality. I mean, I'm saying define air quality is difficult. I mean, we can define the major pollutants that we know, but generally, if you go from that space to the space nearby and then to another space, you can measure different pollutants, right? So, in a sense, that makes it more complicated, we as humans will have different, thresholds for the effects, right? So that is another problem. But I think that is taken up, I mean, considered when for example, WHO is coming up with their guideline values. They take this into account, but they have to make some compromises in the end, so...
Yeah, so I am not a big fan of arbitrary thresholds. If you go to the Wikipedia and have a look at air quality indices, it's so long, right? It goes for pretty much every country. And then you compare the air quality indices for India to, say, I don't know, Denmark. Mm. They're wildly different. Lots of pretty colours. You know, and for some they go from green to red, but some go from green to purple. Is that worse? Maybe. But I've always liked the ASHRAE definition of acceptable air quality, because I don't like putting categories. I don't think it is a categorical variable that you can put categories on it, but it's going to be hugely subjective. So I like the binary approach. It either complies or it doesn't comply. Don't tell me that your air quality is good, because what you might think is good, I might not think is good. But so if we stick with acceptable, it's a binary yes or no. Now, I then think that the way to do that is through a harm budget. And that is that you say
this amount of harm. We can use the DALIs to do that. We don't have to show people what the DALIs are, but we can maybe talk about equivalence to other risks and say that we this is tolerable. And so we try to be less than that. But that also gives us more flexibility as engineers trying to manage the air quality in our spaces using the range of systems that we've discussed today, because if you're in a low particular area, then maybe you can allow more nitrogen dioxide to build up. And the reverse is also true. Now, that's
somebody's got to make that choice, though, haven't they? You know,
what the level of harm is?
Yeah, at a chronic level over a long period of time.
Sure.
That doesn't translate to the in-the-moment decision, whether you're coming up with an algorithm for smart ventilation systems or you're coming up with a testing methodology to test if a ventilation system is working. At some point, you've got to make a call as to say, right, as of right now, in this room that we're in, are these numbers, these thresholds, acceptable?
But I think that's already been done. And it's been done because standards, as they exist now, have attempted to manage indoor air quality, and they've already set that level. So how about we say, well, what's the harm level that these standards already set right now? And what you're going to find, probably, because we've already done this with the ASHRAE standards, is that it's pretty good, you know, compared to other daily risks. So how about we just stick with those? And if we see a good reason to bring it down in the future because all the other daily risks come down, we can act on that and deal with that.
Yeah.
So I think we're already there. And that I think that is a far more objective way of going about things, certainly far more open and honest.
I fully agree. The threshold should be based on how the system actually performed for now.
Mm-hmm.
And if we find reason to make them smaller, then we will do. But for now, the threshold should be defined based on the performance of the prescriptive methods.
Mm.
Do we think we're wildly out on any of them in particular at the moment? These thresholds that already exist, these standards and regulations that already exist, are we missing anything particularly?
Yeah,
you said
I
you
definitely
think you do it pretty well.
I do.
But are there some areas that we think actually... No, I think we're fundamentally wrong here,
If you have an exposure limit value for particulate matter and an exposure limit value for nitrogen dioxide, they should both lead to the same harm. But they don't. Because there's other things bound up in the decision with getting to that exposure limit value. So I think that's not the right way to go at the moment.
All depends. I mean, for the regulators, it's really important to act on specific levels. It's much easier for them to even implement this in practice.
I think there's a slight contradiction, though. So the WHO, when talking about air quality, uses one method. When it talks about drinking method, it does exactly what I advocate.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Ah, well. We're all learning.
Maybe it's easier. Maybe. So maybe the problem is on our side, engineers are scientists who do the measurements, because we do not provide the data that is allowing us to make those estimations.
Yeah. We're not very good with data. I don't think we don't seem to have a basic statistical knowledge when dealing with data.
But not even statistical knowledge. I mean, if the aim is to control against the concentration thresholds, then we will just do against the concentration thresholds, and also we will be measuring and comparing up against this. But if we define the aim slightly differently, so maybe the protocol, measuring protocols, will also modify to provide information that would allow us to make this.
Where are we practically with measuring today? And again, this is another area. In 10 years, it's moved on enormously since TN68 was conceived and written. The monitoring and the sensor landscape has changed out of almost all recognition in 10 years. Where are we today on the premise of you can't manage what you don't measure? We talked about measuring aerolic performance, you know, air movement performance. We've not really spoken about the how do I know that my formaldehyde levels are this or my particulate matter is this. What's your kind of sense of where we are today?
We are in a completely different place.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, everyone can do any measurement that they like. Even about their health, how they feel. I mean, they can diagnose their health, they can diagnose their sleep, they can measure most of the pollutants, the major pollutants that we've been discussing here. So the question is how accurate those measurements are. I don't want to discuss this. It's basically, it actually crawled out from the laboratories to, you know, to the public. Any one of us can do the measurement. This is where we are.
But we are missing standards. We don't have any standard explaining what to measure, what to use to measure it, how to measure it, and why. Yeah, we are missing a standard on this that would give a general framework to explain how to do that. So we've got very good consulting companies that go do indoor environment quality measurement with sensors that are relevant to do this and that perform good work. But we've got also other people just come with low-cost and sensor and will say, alert, alert, we've got a PM, so much PM in your house, you will die soon. But we have nothing standardized, no protocol to do this for now, and we are missing it. And also what to do with this amount of data. So I have one measurement every hour for 1 year in this building. What do I do with that? What indicator gets from that? Do I just do the average? What? And this is also missing.
Which average?
So which average, yeah.
So like with a lot of technology at the moment, the technology is moving faster than the standards and the regulation. Our ability to do stuff is moving quicker than our ability to know what good looks like or to be able to risk manage that. So as of today, like your sense is pretty much most of the stuff that we're talking about that we've been concerned about in TN68, largely we can measure with low-cost sensors, and if not low-cost sensors, near-reference grade sensors periodically. We can get most of that information. The trouble is if somebody asks me today, is this number good or not, they can't point to anything.
That's the ability to make measurements make us blind to ask relevant questions, and this is, I think, the risk of course it's fantastic that we can measure nearly everywhere and every minute, every second, every hour. So as Valerie says, so what? So are we now, we are now basically measuring what has been there for years, but now we are able to demonstrate that this is there. But what to do with this information? How to interpret? Is it what we should, this is it the way how we should develop? What is the major question that should be answered? So what I'm really afraid of is that, you know, which may happen in the future, is that our science will develop in a process of collecting a lot of data and then leaving it out to Python or any other, you know, analytical system to provide us with some, I don't know, correlations, associations from which we will draw conclusions, instead going to the basic and ask, what is it that, why we do this measurement? So I always taught my students is that, and I was taught before them, I had been taught it before them, is that the fact that you have many monitoring instruments doesn't mean that you have to measure everything unless you know why you want to measure it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the true nature of science, understanding the question, is the most important thing. Exactly.
Set it first before you actually go and start doing stuff. I'm sure we've all seen studies where people have just measured stuff and then tried to work out what to do with it. Never works.
Exactly.
Never works.
That's where you get into the causation correlation mess, is because you see stuff happening and you've got no idea what you were asking. Mm. So you start interpreting.
Making new theories.
Yeah, new theories.
Or maybe, you know, dismissing the previous theories because of the new correlations that you see and trusting that they are much better than the other.
What's that map look like, though?
There are broad things we can say about the data, though. You know, if you want to look at a specific data point right now, then that's going to tell you something about your acute response to whatever contaminant is you're measuring. But if you want to think about your chronic response over long term, then you need a median. And that's the central tendency. You know, the 50% of the data is going to be more than that, 50% will be less, and that'll that'll give you a good indication of what's going on. So, I mean, that's fairly straightforward.
Yeah, and look, often, you know, I, like you, have looked at a lot of data from housing over the years. There's the grey, muddly middle bit where it's where you're trying to interpret stuff. But a lot of the data you see is pretty low-hanging fruit stuff. Mm. So, you know, at the end of the day, if your bedroom is getting to 3,500, 4,000 parts per million every single night, then you've probably got a ventilation problem. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't need an academic to sift through that data and look at mediums to tell you that there's a fundamental problem there. If you're cooking and your bedroom's spiking with PM every cooking time, you've probably got an escape of pollutants from the kitchen that you can probably look at dealing with. And I often say this about the residential setting, as long as complex as this all is, there are only so many levers we can pull in a home to affect an outcome. And that's where we get back to some of these basic principles of good background ventilation, good local exhaust. But, you know, at the end of the day, what do you want to... You want to know what you're asking, but you've also got to know what you're capable of doing. Okay. And in a home, we've only got so many tools available to us.
Today.
So that is the other risk of having too many measurements is that we, rather than thinking about solutions, we think about making more measurements. So, and this is what I see, and I said it probably in a different podcast or gremium, is that I think what I see, for example, the literature is full of a lot of information about the measurements, but I think the focus should be on how what to do with this. So, I mean, how to solve the potential problems that are demonstrated by this. And I think that there is not much development. There is some developments, but I think there should be much more development. We are far away, far behind any other technological developments with respect to the solutions in homes. I mean, I don't want to compare to the smartphone, of course, and IT technologies, because it is not the proper reference. But any other, you know, the technologies, they are developing very fast and very well, maybe and providing a better efficiency, better product. Whereas we, with the ventilation, it seems like we stuck. And I don't know, I don't see that revolutionary solutions that, you know, change everything. So I think that there is an opportunity here. I know that we will be speaking later about the research, but I think this is where I see the opportunities for the future research. And we have to remember, we, as you said, I mean, most of the buildings have been built already. And let's assume that 20% of those, or maybe 30%, or maybe 10% of those have chronic problems that can only be solved by some technical solutions like ventilation, for example. So how we are going to do that? Maybe there are better ways of providing ventilation in those premises. So
when it comes to future work, the future research and next steps, perhaps if I ask you each individually what you think, what does a good next 10 years look like on the frame of TN68, what would you like us to be looking back and talking about in 10 years' time? Maybe I'll start with you, Ben, put you on the spot first out of the gate.
Okay, I'd like to see it applied to other spaces. So the principles are there. We've looked at homes, we've evaluated homes again with the Nottingham study in homes. I'd like to see it done for offices, very contentiously, and very importantly, I'd like to see it done for schools and maybe a few other key spaces.
That work that you did predominantly looked at Northern Hemisphere, Western-type homes.
Yeah, global North homes, yeah.
Is there an opportunity to look at other types of homes in other parts of the world that are under more air quality pressure? Could there be better outcomes driven in parts of the world where this could find examples of behaviour change and culture change and fundamentals that could have serious impacts on outcomes? Or are we kind of tinkering at the edges here a little? I know we've been complaining bitterly about the quality of ventilation in our homes in Europe, But if you go to parts of Asia and India and other parts of the developing world, it's a totally different beast. And I wonder if harm work like that could have some serious impacts.
I think the global burden of disease already tells us that smoke inhalation in homes in the global south is already an issue. So I don't think that's going to tell us anything new.
Yeah.
Right? But I think what some of the things we've touched on here, it's completely the opposite end of the spectrum. I think we probably need to think about these incredibly low energy homes like Passive House, about how we make sure that the air quality in those homes is acceptable.
Okay. Fally, what about yourself? What do you think, looking back, if we were having this discussion?
Yeah, what I would love to see in tenure is that ventilation is visible. So that is to say that in a house, you see, so you've got monitoring at all time, and you see the performance of ventilation and how is the indoor air quality in the house at full time. I think we do need to have a sense in our body that is able to feel the indoor air quality, which is not now. So if the heating system is not working, you will feel it. So you will change it. You will do something for it. Right now, if the ventilation is not working, nobody does anything because nobody sees it before it's too late. So I would love to see in 10 years a system where you actually see in the house the indoor air quality, and that the occupant is able to have an impact on it, and the system is able to auto-adjust himself to improve it.
Yeah, I like that. And I think agency is an underutilized tool. If people feel like they can have an... I think one of the challenges we have with air quality is people don't feel like they can change it sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a lack of agency. And if you can make the visible invisible and give people the tools to go, this bedroom needs changing and correcting, and they have the tool to do that, gives them agency.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. My mother would argue that they should have just opened a window. They've had the tool all along.
Yeah, but they don't know when. Well,
they knew when in the past.
What if we could build on what Valerie says so that it's not just air quality that we're talking about, but oral quality, visual quality, full environmental quality?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this isn't considered in isolation. It's just another parameter in the home that relates to our health and well-being.
Yeah, but it's an invisible parameter, and that makes it so difficult. And this is why I would also support here what Valerie is saying.
So Valerie wants to make the invisible visible.
Yeah. So exactly. I mean, we've been discussing it several times during this podcast. I will not repeat myself. I think there is plenty of things that we could see, and I mean, I think we should try to also position the air quality in that microbiome, basically, is what the role it is in our total exposure, right? That there are some attempts to look at this, and they were very difficult to do, but now with the development of the solutions for personal monitoring, I think we will be well off to better understand that. But I think what I really would like to see in 10 years is that we think about air quality in our home, or maybe indoor environment at our home, as that it is as important as retrofitting our kitchen, retrofitting our bathroom, you know, having a beautiful garden around the house, putting a new facade. And so it's just that it is a part of the quality of life that not only is not visible, but also that it actually is not only the visible, but is also a part of the good that it brings. So the fact that I know that I live in a house that is free of risks, or maybe very low risk, maybe it makes me less stress. So maybe it will have a positive effect on my health because I have a lower stress. So thinking about that, it's not only the negative in the negative terms that we only minimize those all harm, but it also can create good for us. And I think this is where we can probably do a lot. Also, changing the mind of people when we visualize this and then we present it as the additional benefit for our living, then probably it will be fantastic if it happens. Hopefully in 20 years or maybe 30, but at least the direction.
And the performance-based will help for that, because right now with the prescriptive flow rate, if you multiply the flow rate by 2, nobody understands the impact of multiplying the flow rate by 2. But if you show the indicator in terms of performance, you say, okay, the mandatory level is 2,000 ppm, but with this system you will reach 1,000 ppm. Here you sell something, you sell an improvement.
Yeah.
And the performance-based should help to...
Because it's a law of depreciating returns, so that's very important.
Yeah. And I think the point that you made, Pavel, was interesting about the microbiome. There are some things that we there is no good level of. Like, I think that's understood. You know, there are carcinogens and things, you know, endocrine disruptors.
The particulates is no good level.
But there are certain things that we would class as pollutants, I guess, that you can make the argument there is some level of natural benefit to. Like, and we've understood that for years, that, you know, living in a completely sanitized environment is no good for anybody. I think to try and understand this new term that we're hearing now, this total exposome, and the microbiome of the building, understanding what actually good looks like. Because I don't hear people, we talk about harm, but we don't hear a lot of talk about what does good actually look like. Is it just a lack of harm, or is there a state that we should be? Because it's very handy to be able to target a result, and at the moment we're just trying to remove. We're not at a position where there's a good, and I think that would be an interesting conversation.
The good is it being acceptable. I really don't feel very uncomfortable with saying what's good and what's not.
Because we're talking about risk and harm, though, Ben. I think the interesting thing is to turn this into a positive narrative and say, surely there's an environment that is actually a positive influence on our health, not just an absence of risk.
So it comes to quality adjusting your life. So it's the life years gained from a space, which is it's another econometric. We've just introduced them right at the end, but it's a kind of inverse. So instead of talking about all the harm it's going to give you, it talks about the improvement you're going to get from it. This is something that's been suggested before, and I think it's a great idea.
We might be getting a bit philosophical for the end of the 2-hour conversation, but this natural state.
You're clearly uncomfortable with it, so maybe there's definitely something to it, and you're not the first person to say that.
I think it's whether you believe that the life is a natural breakdown, like and always is. So there is no
dying from the day
negative,
you were born.
Positive at an individual level. It is always about reduction. There is only one direction of travel ultimately, right? So maybe DALI is the ultimate metric there in that sense. The microbiome is the classic example of that for me. If we introduce UV into an environment, for example, is there a point at which we eliminate the good?
I think moisture get a range, so that's an easy one.
Yeah.
But like temperature, you say, okay, it need to be above 18, but not more than 24. But when we talk about pollutants, and I'm only talking about pollutants, so humidity is not one, CO2 is not one, there is not just an acceptable value and a non-acceptable value. There is not a range of pollutant. You just set up a max level, but you don't put a range on it. And I don't think for pollutants you can say, oh, if you are below a certain level of pollutant, it's bad for you.
Yeah. So if you set your harm budget at, say, 700 DALIs, which is what resulted from the ASHRAE evaluation, then the threshold of each contaminant is whatever leads to 300 DALIs.
Yeah.
Because you just assume... I mean, so.
But it's just one value, it's not a range. You cannot say, okay, you should not be below 500 DALIs.
No, the range is 0.2.
Yeah, it's 0, I mean, of course.
No, it is a continuum. I think it's very important to understand that there will be a continuum, and that continuum can be different for different people. And then understanding those basic principles, yeah. I think, of course, it will not help us with engineering, but maybe, yes, maybe we will make solutions that basically deal with the basics, and then the rest will be done with a different solutions for anyone. Yeah. Else. So I think this is what I was referring to when I was saying that there is no development in ventilation, in a sense that that we are not thinking out of box. We try to sort of all the time think that this is a method that will satisfy everyone and then provide that prescriptive rate. But maybe we should not think in this way. We should start thinking differently.
So the data that we've talked about and the way of thinking about harm is population-based. It's exactly. Not personal. Exactly. Yeah. So there are always going to be outliers in there. There's always going to be some people who aren't affected by any of it, and some are hyper...
So this is a sort of a baseline. And this is a baseline, and then we can up-adjust, or we can stay at the baseline or up-adjust or whatever, depending on what are the needs. And I think this is the way how we should start thinking about... the indoor environment should be thought like that. Because otherwise we will be stuck on the, you know, one central value that will be determined for everyone. I mean, that is not the way to, at least, first of all, it's not the way how we should control indoor environment, but secondly, it's not the way how we develop and advance in the solutions and innovation.
Yeah. My hope for 10 years, because I'm allowed to put one in, is host's benefit.
Of course. It's your party.
My party. My hope is that in 10 years' time, the supply chain feels and accepts the responsibility that they have and the impacts that they have on people's lives. That this has a trade, that ventilation has a career, that ventilation has standards that are acceptable, and consumer protection that surrounds it, and that people feel the weight of responsibility that they have when putting a ventilation system in to people's homes. Because I think a lot of the problems that we have in our society is that ventilation isn't valued. Mm. And my hope would be in 10 years' time that it's valued, that a 16-year-old can leave school and see ventilation as a career, as a trade, as an apprenticeship, as a thing in its own right to be proud of and to take responsibility of, and to understand that they're going to have an impact on people's lives. And I think that would be a wonderful aspiration for 10 years' time, because at the moment, we don't have that. In most countries, ventilation isn't a trade.
And that would mean that we would actually make a useful work and we would not just be moving air.
Yes.
I mean, my kids always say, oh, yeah, mommy is doing ventilation. She's just moving air, you know. And that can be useful at some point.
Thanks for listening. That was a special episode of the Air Quality Matters podcast in partnership with the AIVC as part of their broader comms project, looking at some of their critical documents over the last few years and bringing them back to life in new ways, including conversations through the medium of this podcasts. I hope you enjoyed it. It was introduced with Arnold Jensen, Professor of Building Physics at Ghent University. And the guests on the podcast were Ben Jones from Nottingham University, Valerie LePrince from CERIMA, and of course, Pavel Wargotsky from DTU University in Denmark. See you next week.